Hyperion to a satyr.
Welcome to the 27th episode of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid, and having just finished my scene-by-scene deep dive look at Act 3 through the lens of not only the text, but many film, television, comics, and music adaptations, today we are taking a look back at the act. But we'll also cover an adaptation we haven't touched yet. Hamlet, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, as seen in The Last Action Hero. And that was Dr. Ange's idea because, yes, he's my very special guest to get through all this. Hi, Ange.
Hey, Siskoid. Thank you so much for deeming me worthy to be on the show, which I feel is quite literate and erudite, and I'm going to try to hold up my end.
Well, you're a doctor. Although from experience, because my dad was a doctor, you're my age. So it's not like he went to like a classical college and his library had a lot of these kind of texts. But I found that doctors in their adult life are more like into genre stuff, mystery novels, that kind of stuff. But have you kept in touch with some sort of literature?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Because obviously you read comics. I mean, that's how we know you.
Yeah. I definitely read comics. I went to a liberal arts college for pre-med, a college that is not known for its pre-med program and is known more for the broad education that it gives you. I don't think I'm, you know, spilling the beans here when I say I went to Providence College, because anybody that follows me on Twitter sees a lot of basketball talk about that team. And I went to an all-boys Catholic high school. And so all of those places were, you know, you were exposed to classic literature. Providence College has a two-year course of Western Civ, which takes you from ancient Greece through World War II. And you cover all of the religion, philosophy, art, literature, history of Western civilization during that time period. And so there are books from those experiences that I have kept that are on my bookshelf. So I have Beowulf, and I have the Iliad, and I have the complete works of Shakespeare, and I have, separate from that, a portable Hamlet and a portable Macbeth, poetry from World War I, whatever the classes were that really struck me in college, I have tried to keep that stuff up.
Yeah, you're not just a science boy.
No, not at all. I try not to be. I try to, you know, I think it actually helps me with patience when I can sort of like speak broadly and, you know, metaphorically and things like that.
So what is your experience with Shakespeare in general?
I can vividly remember the first time that I heard or learned of Hamlet was a clue that Dr. Destiny gave the Justice League in one of their issues, where he had hidden different like doomsday devices in different places, and one of the clues was to sleep perchance to dream, which Superman said, you know, a famous Danish prince said that in Hamlet, and they went and found the device. But otherwise, like many Americans, I will say, if you go to a high school, you read Julius Caesar in your freshman year, you read Romeo and Juliet in your sophomore year, you read Macbeth in your junior year, and you read Hamlet in your senior year. So those are like the four big ones. And then again, when I went to college, it was very similar. We covered Hamlet and Macbeth. And I've done my best to sort of like try now and then to read more. I like Midsummer Night's Dream. Macbeth is definitely my favorite. Probably makes me a little bit warped. But
and wrong.
Yeah. But I enjoy it. And I specifically I like to see it on the stage and or in film. Obviously, I'm a big movie guy. So I can say like 2 years ago, just as the pandemic was breaking, there was a version of Much Ado About Nothing on the Boston Commons. So it was like live outside theater that I thought was quite entertaining. It's probably the last thing that I've seen live of Shakespeare.
You're lucky because over here, there aren't many Shakespearean productions unless they're students or very much amateur stuff, but I still go and enjoy it. There's something about the words that always works for me. So Macbeth is your favorite, huh? Okay.
Well, yeah.
You're banned from the show. No, this is an ongoing fight I have with my friend Ryan Blake, who will be on this show eventually to defend his point.
I look forward to it.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite Hamlet adaptation?
Yeah, you know, I will say that the one that I've only seen it twice, and I always say, oh, I should buy it and have it in my collection. Like the Bronig one, I think, is just everything that it should be in terms of grandeur, completeness, great actors, like everything about that. So I would say, like, if you said, which one is my favorite, I would say that one. Which one have I seen the most? I've seen the Olivier one probably 10 times. Whenever it's on Turner Classic Movies, which I am usually tuned into, I'll be like, oh, I should watch this again. Or even if I see it, I'll DVR it so that I can watch it one more time, because I find that one fascinating as well. In fact, there's something about that movie, I don't want to spoil it because it's something that happens at the end of the play, and I don't know if you want me to spoil Shakespeare or not, because you're going to...
You can. It's not...
But, you know, in that one, that was like when you started the show and you were like, I mean, you do such a great deep dive of like talking about the inflection of words and like the staging of things and different things like that. I always assume that Gertrude doesn't realize she's drinking poison at the end of the play. But in the Olivier one, the way it's acted, it's quite clear it looks like she's committing suicide. She knows what she's doing. And the first time that I saw the Olivia one, I was like, well, that's weird. Who would ever think of that? And now that I've heard you deep dive through all of this, it's like, wow, I have to. It's infinite how many different ways that you could put this show on, you know, this play on, inflect on different words, have somebody in the scene, not on the scene, on the stage, right? That has just like broadened my appreciation of this 1,000%. So it's the Olivier one that I would say I've seen the most and probably could talk about the most. But the Bronig one, I think, is my favorite.
And it's interesting because later we're going to be talking about the Last Action Hero Hamlet. And it kind of jumps out of the Olivier version.
Yes, yes.
The kid's looking at that movie and then he imagines his action hero in the role. After Hamlet refuses to kill Claudius that time in the confessional. All right, well, let's talk about Act 3 a little bit. The big questions, the big ambiguities. This is the act in which we get to be or not to be. So this is a big, I mean, it's the longest time that Hamlet is on stage, all of these scenes together. It's like he seems to never leave the stage. And to be or not to be is in there. The big question that people ask about this scene is, does he know he's being watched? Similarly, I mean, he attacks Ophelia during these moments, right?
Yeah.
So how much of this is sincere? How much of this is because he knows someone's behind the arras? What's your take on...
If I can start with the Ophelia stuff first, because I feel...
Yeah.
More, so I've said that in high school, the English teacher that was teaching me the play said, nunnery, he means whorehouse.
Right.
And so I've always read it as that. But this time, and again, I've been reading along as you've been going through this. He says a line in the middle of it that says, like, where's your father? Right? Like, he actually asks her, where is your father? And for me, I feel... He doesn't realize he's being watched until he says that line, when I think he probably notices that he's being watched. And so I think his words to Ophelia, because I think that is a turning point, that's when he recognizes that he's being watched, become much harsher afterwards. Like, I'm not being watched, so I might actually mean go to a nunnery because I don't want you to be involved in all of these things. But now that I know I'm being watched, I'm going to amp it up a little bit and be a little bit more mean. And maybe this time I mean... go to our house. So I think that's the point where he recognizes that he's being watched. And so I think to be or not to be is just him. And I think it's much sadder than other parts of the play where he is pretending to be mad. And so I think that's actually his truth. In fact, if I would stage it, of course, it would have to be a movie. I might make it like a voiceover to be his internal thoughts instead of being said out loud.
Mm. And I agree with you that there is a turning point in the text and that he should not be, you know, all immediately all knowing. It can't be a put on.
Yeah.
If it's a put on, then like too much of what he says loses resonance, right? It becomes just part of the mad act. And then, well, is it really him speaking? And what we want from our soliloquies is the character speaking and overhearing themselves and, you know, having epiphanies based on their own rationalization of something. That's Shakespeare's great talent. The characters speak, but they're not cartoons. They're not just saying what needs to be said or like some grand speech where the author is speaking to the audience. No, the character is speaking to themselves and then react to themselves. And after a soliloquy, there should be a change in the character, or at least, if not a change, peace with who they are, essentially. So he needs to not be faking it. I agree with that. But there is some value, perhaps, in still having if it's a voiceover where it's just his thoughts, then the king and Polonius can't hear it. But what if they do hear it?
Yeah.
There's some value in that where at that point, he seems more serious. He is talking about suicide. That could solve Claudius's problem. But at the end of that, they do go, let's send him to England, etc. And the king is not convinced it's madness. So if they overhear this part, which is more is played more seriously, he might go, no, this guy can reason.
Yeah.
The rest is an act. So, I mean, there's value in that. But some directors have used it as voiceover, right? So where he's completely somewhere else and the king and Polonius aren't there. Let's talk a bit about the mousetrap. Does the mousetrap work as Hamlet thinks it does? Because I'm not sure the text is clear on that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Again, I've read and reread this act several times over the last couple of weeks to try to get in preparation of this. And so you think that when Claudius says, give me some light in a way, that that is such a interjection by him that you think that it must have affected him in some way that he felt he just had to get out of there. And so in prior readings, and again, I have to, commend you for making me think and rethink this play each time you put on a show. And when I read it this time, in the past, I've always been clearly it works, right? He says, give me some light. He says, get the heck out of here, right? Or he gets the heck out of there. And then he immediately goes to that confessional and tries to start to rationalize what he did. So in my mind, I like to think that it works. But the part that sticks out to me now is how flat Horatio responds, did you see him? And it's not like he's like, yeah, we got him, right? He's like, no. He's like, I saw him. And he's like, yeah, we saw him. And he's like, yes, I did note that he was in the room, right? And so it's such an understated response from Horatio. It's like there's a period at the end of it. It's not even an exclamation point that it makes me wonder if it didn't work quite as well. He thinks it does.
Hamlet doesn't let the ploy reach its apogee. It's not we showed in the play, the guy poisons the guy, the king poisoned in the ear and all the details are correct. No, he jumps on stage and he starts reciting what's going to happen. It's an accusation.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, what is troubling Claudius sometimes, it depends on the staging, but what could be troubling Claudius isn't so much the details of the play, is how accusatory Hamlet is being. And then it's wait, the entire court is here. And he's making these accusations. He's been, slinging mud at his mother, and he's acted obscenely with Ophelia. And now, okay, enough of this.
Yeah.
I've been humoring this boy because Gertrude, but at this point, nah.
Yeah.
No. And he ends it. And some of the Claudius's, especially Patrick Stewart's, the two versions he's done, have been very, very calm and still the great politician. But then you're right. He immediately goes to the confessional. And then that's the first time, really, that he admits it to the audience.
Yeah. I'll say, really, reading it this time, I've always sort of wondered, there's that opening part where Hamlet is talking to the actors about, you should act this way, but don't act that way too much, but you should also act this way. I wonder if that's mm-hmm. A little bit of foreshadowing that he's like, I don't trust these guys to put the play on the way that I want it to be put on. Because then all of a sudden he does jump on the stage and say, do you see what he's doing? Let me make sure that you understand what's happening. Because I never quite understood the purpose of that part other than, again, to show maybe a little bit of peek behind the curtain of how plays go on and how directors direct plays and things like that for the crowd.
Well, I mean, I understand it as, Shakespeare, authors... a lot of my literary studies, especially in a later century, let's say the 18th century was a lot like this. People were just, the authors were just throwing shade. They were rappers, basically. it was diss tracks. And you would read the next poem by this guy because he was blasting this other guy and that guy would respond. And they did a lot of this. So I feel like that's maybe there's a few places in Hamlet where this happens. Conversations with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern and then here with the players, the how to. And it seems to throw shade at other dramatists saying, that other theater, oof, that's not good acting. It's the flavor of the time. He seems to be responding to things that are popular while he's making art. And that's, we've always lived that reality, art versus what is popular, and where do those two things meet, right? Yeah. So I feel like that speech is in there. But so, you know, you're responding to other things and you're wondering, well, is that necessary? And a lot of people cut it out. Where it becomes necessary to me is thematically, because Hamlet is a man who is acting. And it's a little bit like All the World's a Stage, which is, of course, in another play, but that's what Denmark becomes. It's a stage. And the fact that he's acting out things, and that, you know, at the very beginning in Act One, he's going like, this grief that I'm feeling, that I'm showing, like you're saying all these symptoms that I have that you don't like, you're making it out like these are things that a man might play. You know, so he's always relating himself back to being an actor. And I think, according to these conversations he has with friends, theater was of interest to him when he was in school. So he sees himself in that and he sort of adopts that role. So thematically, it works. It's interesting to have it here rather than in another play. But you brought up a super interesting point. Yeah, he doesn't trust these actors, no matter how good he thinks they are. These instructions are a symptom of his psyche, where he doesn't trust anyone. If they don't do this right, my whole plan goes to crap. And maybe there is a staging of this where they don't do a good job, you know, where he feels forced because it's like, oh, it's taking too long. And I like it. I think it's the Branagh one, right? Where the king and queen seem very distracted. They're feeding each other, and you know, so he doesn't like that behavior, but also, shit, they're not watching.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so he takes over.
You almost think of like, you could do it like in Amadeus when the Duke yawns, right? Like, oh my God, he yawned in Mozart. Like you could try to stage it that way. And then he has to be like, oh, I have to get everybody's attention again.
Right. They do a little bit like that in Shakespeare in Love, where, you know, Will Shakespeare has a play, let's go cough through it.
Yeah.
And the queen is sleeping and, you know, it's kind of that. And I think that's taken from this, you know, the sort of malaise that the author has, that his work won't be appreciated because you kind of have to listen. You have to pay attention to this, right? It's a complicated text.
Yeah.
Okay, Claudius runs to the confessional. Do you think that makes him more or less sympathetic, this whole scene? It basically explains himself.
I don't think it makes him sympathetic. I think, you know, especially at the tail end in the middle of it, he says something like, how can I like confess that this is a sin when I'm still enjoying all of the things that it got me? And then, of course, he ends it with the, you know, words can go up to heaven, but or thoughts go up to heaven, but nothing, you know, I'm still down here on earth. So I don't think so. And this is the part, like one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about Last Action Hero is that for me, I know that there's a turning point for you coming up, I know, but for me, it's sort of like, this is the time that he could do it, right? Like if you were really hell-bent on revenge, who cares, right? You just want to like off this guy. Maybe that's the American in me, right? I've watched a little bit too many. I've watched too many westerns where people are just gunned down. It doesn't make him more sympathetic. If anything, for me, it sort of made it that again, like all of these things fall in line. The mousetrap worked because he saw what happened. He's sort of like faced with his own thing. He goes to this place and says, "Boy, like I really did this terrible thing." Nah, you know, right? So at least that's the way I read it. But I'd love to hear, again, what like your particular thoughts are.
Well, I mean, that's a perfectly legitimate take if I play devil's advocate.
Yeah.
One of the performances I really love for Claudius is Derek Jacobi's in Branagh's, because he does make him more sympathetic, just generally. He seems like to be a nicer man than a lot of the other Claudiuses that we've had. But in this moment, I've always felt it's like he regrets that he did the thing, but also accepts that he doesn't want to sacrifice the things he did it for. I repent, but can I repent? Like, I feel really bad, and I feel the guilt, and this has just brought it to the fore. And he has a moment earlier also where he's like, oh, Polonius tells him something and it triggers something in him. It's like, oh, you're just reminding me that I have this sin on my soul. And here he is in the confessional, and he tries to pray. He does try to repent, but then realizes, no, wait a minute, I can't truly repent if I still have all the effects of my sin.
Yeah.
So unless I'm ready to give up the crown, the queen, the money, the fame, the power, this doesn't mean anything. I'm just going through the motions, which is kind of paraphrasing Hamlet here, right?
Yeah.
This physic prolongs thy days. So depends how you play it. But he seems more sympathetic to me because he does have a sort of self-realization. At least he knows he's the villain. Like he feels guilty So he's not a complete psychopath. But of course, once he realizes, no, I am the villain, then there's no stopping him. And he's the villain from then on. From then on, he wants to be, he wants to continue to murder people.
Yeah.
So like that moment, yes, more sympathetic. Everything that comes after, no. Because he's, like I said, I think the soliloquies, either you're going to change something in yourself after hearing yourself speak, or you're just going to realize, no, this is who I am, and this is the direction I've chosen, and I am at peace with that. And I think that's, whereas Hamlet maybe doesn't commit suicide and, you know, eventually, through a number of soliloquies, accepts that he has to act. Claudius has a very short soliloquy, a prayer, but it is doing the opposite thing. It is saying, I'm on the only track I can be on.
And I know eventually we'll talk to the Gertrude seat at the end of this act, which I think, again, is a very different sort of response to being confronted with the things that you've done, which I think works well. I mean, I can only speak for me, but like, you know, there have been times that you've done something that might be like a little bit odious, and then somebody comes up to you and says like, dude, what are you doing? And there are times that you're like, well, I can't go back in time, so I guess I just have to run with it. So not murder, of course.
No. Speaking of murder, the first murder occurs in this act, and it's Polonius. So let me ask, deserved or not?
I think every show that you've put on of this podcast, I've said like, oh my God, I think Polonius is just like a doofus, right? He's just like kind of an idiot. And I think it's not deserved because I think he's kind of like harmless in terms of like, he's not an intelligent man or a schemer in any sort of way. He puts himself in danger. And so I don't think it's deserved. I do think he talks so much in this play and doesn't make a lot of sense to me that I laugh every time he says like, oh, I am slain, right? Like he can't even die silently. He has to say something, right? Like, oh my God, dude, shut up. So he is not the victim that Hamlet is looking to kill. It obviously pushes the plot forward tremendously in terms of like now, oh, another father has died and another son wants to get revenge and like all of those mirrors that you've talked about. So I don't think deserved. But before you tell me your thoughts, which I'm intrigued on. I also wonder, Hamlet says, like, is it the king, right? He thinks he might have stabbed Claudius, but didn't he just leave Claudius? I'm trying to think, like, I guess, yeah. does he think, like, Claudius took, like, at super speed, took a secret passage? Like, how could he get in front of him? And so I don't know if that's anything to do with staging or anything like that that would make that more believable, because that's the part that I don't quite understand. If he truly thinks that he's killing Claudius, then he's still just confessed and prayed and probably hasn't sinned in between. And so I don't know if that's going to do anything different than what you could have done. And is this just a sign that he's like turned the corner?
Well, spying would have been the sin.
Yeah.
The extra sin. But it doesn't make sense except if you're, you know, in the throes of lunacy. So I think that the question that we've often come back to, and we almost have to again because the ghost appears or seems to appear in this section, is Hamlet mad? You know, that question. And I think it comes in waves. That's what I've decided ultimately after all of these episodes. Hamlet is not insane, but he lets his emotions take over. And in those moments, he is truly insane. So there's a put on, but there's also a real mental health problem caused by all of these elements in his life. So in that moment where he's raging against his mother, where he's elated that the play worked, he's also bitter and angry that he couldn't kill Claudius right then and there. In that moment, he's enraged against his mother because she shouts for help. And then somebody behind the arras shouts. He doesn't even register the voice. I mean, he would have recognized it's not Claudius's voice, presumably. So he starts stabbing. Right, what he really wants to do is stab his mom.
Yeah.
What he really, really wants to do is stab Claudius. He's in a stabby mood. And Polonius just happens to be there. I don't know if he's deserving it. I agree with you that doesn't deserve it in the sense that, you know, he wasn't the actual target. And obviously Hamlet didn't want to kill his future father-in-law or anything. But in a cosmic sense, he kind of deserves it for being that fly that turns around the rotten core of Denmark. He made love to this employment. Is that the line? It's something in him that is corrupt, that he wants to be close to power and that he's chosen the wrong side. So in a way, cosmically, he deserves to die as much as any person in this play, which seems to be all of them by the end or almost. But just like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, he's a sycophant. and he gets hoisted on his own petard.
Yeah.
So in that sense, he deserves it. But you're right. He hasn't done anything. An eye for an eye, this is way over the line.
Yeah. Like you say, he's the sycophant that wants to be in your power. He uses his daughter as like a tool, right? In terms of like, let me bring you into the machinations that I want. You act like this. You go there. You read this. So I think he's kind of a scumbag. So maybe. but yes, that was not the intention for him to kill Polonius. And he unfortunately dies because of his acts. So
did you think in this portion that the ghost was real? Or that he was a figment of Hamlet's imagination?
You've made me question a lot of what I just routinely took for truth as I read. So I've always been like, the ghost is real.
Right.
The ghost just doesn't want to expose himself to Gertrude because he wants this revenge to happen through Hamlet. And if Gertrude sees the ghost, like, that might muck up the plan. So I think it's real. Now, why would he then show himself to Horatio and all of the others? I think to get Hamlet there to then tell him what he wants him to do. So I think it's real. I don't think that he's this deep in insanity that he's like schizophrenic and seeing things that aren't there.
I agree. I think the ghost has its own rules. It kind of controls what he wants to do. But I mean, we do have to contend. I think the reason why this idea of the ghost maybe not being real exists is that he doesn't appear in the same way every time. The first time he's like furious, he's a vengeance demon. And then in this portion, he's kinder, he's sweeter. It's like, be kind to your mom. And very often directors will dress him differently. And it makes you think, hold on, maybe like there's this creature from hell and maybe he's working through purgatory and he's in a better place. But certainly he's there to remind Hamlet that Gertrude was not to be touched. And he did say that in the very first speech that he got. Don't lay this on your mother. You know, leave your mother alone. The villain is Claudius. And Hamlet has never really believed that. And that's why he loses his way. So the ghost reappears. I have to agree that the simplest solution, which is often the best, the ghost does appear. He's just not, you know, visible to everyone.
When you posed this question as one of the things we would be talking about, I was like, okay, in what instance would I think that it might not be real? And the whole thing about Hamlet is like, he never acts, right? He doesn't act. And the one time that he acts swiftly is when he kills Polonius, right? Pulls out the sword immediately and stabs. And so if you say he's just completely insane in that moment, enraged, then maybe you could say this has all been building up to this thing and this has been truly in his mind. But that's a stretch for me. I think the ghost is real, just like it was in the first act.
You're highlighting the line, what a rash and bloody deed is this. Rash acts are not really Hamlet's thing. You know, I'm going to read feedback later, and a lot of it is yours. Thank you, by the way. And I'm not going to repeat some of the things that we're saying here, obviously, but you're the one who has the point that, like, the confessional scene is the turning point in the play for you.
Him not killing Claudius is the turning point in the play for me because he could have done it. And then I think he regrets it so much that everything else that happens afterwards unravels. And I think that this is like the first, like, oh, I should have done it then. Okay, I'll just do it now. Wrong guy. So That's where I think the turning point is, and that this is, you know, aftershocks of that.
It's the turning point in the sense of a what if.
Yeah.
Uatu the Watcher takes this point and then changes it. And that's what we'll see with the Arnold stuff later. For me, the turning point is this section, the killing of Polonius, because something that doesn't happen could be a turning point. Historically, it's, you know, that's where you can change the story. But the turning point in the sense that now he's gone too far and things will proceed from here no matter what is the killing of Polonius. Killing Polonius makes him get sent to England ASAP with death orders on his head, makes Ophelia go mad and commit suicide herself. I'm going to say commit suicide here, but obviously I'm going to be talking in Act 4 that it's not necessarily suicide, the way it's described. Also, Laertes is going to come back. He's almost going to overthrow the king. He's going to set things into motion that end up killing, with all the poison stuff, killing himself, Hamlet, the king, the queen. So Polonius's death is the linchpin is perhaps the better term. Like, if it's not the turning point, it's at least the linchpin. Yeah. To the rest of the play?
I agree. That's the first domino that sets the rest of the trail down.
Now, my last question about this last scene here, does Gertrude turn? He kind of tells her his secret, and then he asks her not to go to bed with Claudius and to keep her distance and so on. And he tells her, I'm not mad. I'm just using madness as a ploy. etc. She stays with the king. The queen's not going to leave Elsinore. But there's no real dialogue to support either, you know, either way, if she sticks by him, Claudius, or sticks by her son. Does Gertrude turn for you?
Her interactions with Hamlet in this, I think she does turn. And I think that this is where sometimes a buddy comes up to you and says, like, dude, what are you doing? And you're and you realize everything that you've done. So for me, I think he confronts her about everything that she's done and his plans. And I think that she's truly affected by it. And so I think she does turn.
I mean, most mothers, if given the choice between a child and here a second husband, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
We'll choose the child, right? It's that's just how it is. So it is believable. I think you can play the queen as more sinister, but I think what we were talking about earlier about the Olivia version where the queen drinks the cup willingly. And there is something to that where it's like he's handing out the cup and she grabs the cup and drinks it, saving her son from this cup of poison, drinking it first. So having her really believe in Hamlet and turning against the king without showing it, because of course that would be a dangerous situation, can lead to that particular ending, which I think is particularly satisfying.
I agree. Again, I'm just looking through the book. Like, you know, at the beginning of that scene, she keeps saying, like, speak to me no more, because he's, like, saying all of the terrible things that she's done. And I think that that's sort of her, like, oh, I'm, like, really, you know, he's shoving my nose in it. I realize, like, now that I look at it from a different angle, I really am pretty gross, like killing my husband and sleeping with his brother. And then so that at the end when she's like, I won't say anything of this, like I think she means it.
Yeah, I think that's you can have a more sinister queen, but I think that would be like trying to innovate. I think as written, but Gertrude is so underwritten, and I've said this often, that you could do many things with her here, and it would be in the acting, and it would be, you know, it would just like show up later in the cup scene, the Ophelia scene. These are things that we're going to have to keep an eye on through the next two seasons of the show. All right, we're there. The Arnold Schwarzenegger last action hero, Hamlet.
Yeah.
Hey, Claudius. You killed my father. Big mistake.
Something is rotten in the state of Denmark, and Hamlet is taking out the trash.
Stay thy hand, fair prince.
Who said I'm fair?
To tell this sweet prince good night.
To be or not to be. Not to be.
You selected this. It's really Mel Gibson's casting taken to the next level. You had Mad Max as Hamlet, and here you have the Terminator as Hamlet. It's funny. It's fun. In the context of it is that the kid is listening to this, you know, the teacher is teaching Hamlet at school, and she shows the Olivier Hamlet. And at that point, the confessional scene, the kid goes, do it. Stop talking and do it.
Yeah.
And then, boom, we're in this fantasy film where it's Arnold Schwarzenegger in his true persona, you know, his film persona of the 80s, being Hamlet. Why did you pick this, and what do you love about it?
I don't remember almost anything of The Last Action Hero other than this scene. But when I saw this scene, like, it lives rent-free in my mind. I just think it's perfect. So I would agree. I think that he's most like his character in Predator, right? He's got the super short cigar. He's, like, draped with weapons. I like that it starts with the teacher saying, like, you might know Laurence Olivier from a Polaroid commercial, or as Zeus of Clash of the Titans, right? Like, not as this, like, super great actor, right? And then it opens with Claudius. The first line is he goes, like, oh, bosom black, and all the kids giggle, right? Because the word bosom in the sixth grade, that's a funny word. So all of that kind of, like, sat a little bit true. And then again, I've already told you that when I read this, I was like, I don't understand why he just doesn't off the guy. And so seeing this kid character say that was like, oh my God, I would like, that's what I was thinking when I first read this play. I didn't quite understand why I didn't do it. And then it flips into the perfect 80s Schwarzenegger, right? Where he's like, hey, Claudius, you killed my father. Bad idea, right? Throws him out of the window. You know, at one point we see him, he's like holding the skull of Yorick. He like flings it and hits a soldier, you know, in the head and knocks him out.
Where's Tom Arnold as Horatio?
Yeah. And then he goes to kill Polonius and he's like, you know, spare your hand, you know, fair prince. And he's like, who said I was fair? Pulls out machine guns. It becomes completely, completely foolish. But the best part of this for me, you know, there are lines of both actually this play and there's lines of movies that are part of my lexicon. And like when he goes to be or not to be. Not to be, and blows up Elsinore is like, I laugh every time I see it. Every single time I see it, he pulls, you know, he's like lighting his cigar up, you know, not to be. And then in the background, the whole thing goes up. It's just, if you say that Hamlet is a man of inaction, then this is Hamlet as 100% a man of action in like the most like ridiculous sort of way. And so I just think it's a beautiful contrast of like what a sixth grader or an eighth grader might think of when he's reading this, when he would much rather have it be something more, you know, fun.
You're sort of revealing yourself as a Macbeth fan because he's rash. He acts without thinking. He's the anti-Hamlet. I've often said that. We still, I think, looking at this like it's a minute 20, I think we can still draw some interesting things about Shakespeare's Hamlet in the way that they did this. One of my notes here is exactly the to be or not to be. That is the most famous line in literature. I'm not going to even put English literature literature. And here he speaks it not to himself, which is usually what is done, but to Elsinore, to rotten Denmark. And if you were to cut the speech that came after, if it was just these lines and you just cut the speech, it would kind of work, right? You would relate it to, but I think it works either way. Okay. The whole to be or not to be speech about this suicide, about going to the, I mean, he's using a metaphor of the undiscovered country. A country when the play takes place in, you know, has to do with the state of Denmark itself, represented by its monarchs, the new order that will come from Fortinbras. So that metaphor, using the word country here, is supposed to make us clue in, oh yeah, you know, this is all about Denmark, really. So the fate of the nation really hangs in the balance of these courtly machinations. It all hinges on the events of the play, whether, you know, Claudius or Hamlet will live or die, or so what happens to Denmark after that? And I mean, the answer is those versions of Denmark are not to be.
Yeah.
So when you just take it out of context like this and make it, well, you know, let's slap an explosion behind it. It's funny, obviously, but also that's the crux of the play. Will Hamlet and Claudius blow this place up? And they do. They do.
It's true.
So this is a crystallization of what actually happens in the play. You can watch 4 hours of it and you kind of get to the same thing you do here in a minute. So it's very efficient storytelling, but it does bring me back to those words and say, yeah, those words are more pregnant than they first appeared, even though they're very, very pregnant already, you know, but you're seduced by the idea that it's about suicide. And is he talking to himself or is he being overheard? And you're thinking, but ultimately, it's really about the fate of this country, which has been spoken of since the beginning. We got a history lesson from Horatio. You know, Hamlet's first speech is all about this unweeded garden, which is Denmark. They keep talking about Denmark as this rotten state. Yeah, points to Last Action Hero for this.
Yeah, and I'll say, I also like, you know, there's the voiceover of like the trailer guy, right? Who's like, there's something rotten in the state of Denmark, right?
Love it. So it just goes to show how many lines are well known. They do the Sweet Prince one as well. Like, this sweet prince won't say goodnight or whatever it is. And to be or not to be, of course. But every line is kind of famous. That you would be like an action audience. You're going to see a Schwarzenegger film. They put this in here. And you know all the lines. You get all the jokes.
Yeah.
Because they're so famous, you know, and badass. Like, if you turn them the way they are here, he turns them into something that sounds badass. Just the, like, changing the tone of it doesn't invalidate it. Actually heightens it in some ways, you know. And I love the bit that is not in the play. It's not the text of the play. It's "Stay thy hand, fair prince," that Polonius says. Yeah. Who's that up there? But it goes to what we were talking about Polonius earlier. Was that fair?
Yeah.
And it's not fair. And it's not fair. And this little trailer knows it. Like, we're doing jokes, but we also know the text. You know, it's not like someone who hasn't read it writes this little piece just to mock it. No, no, it's someone who knows it, you know, and is as so the jokes are appropriate. So I thought it was quite fun to rewatch this little bit because it still tells me something about Hamlet.
Amazing.
Any final thoughts, Ange?
Well, I will say I can't wait to hear your friend talk about Macbeth. And should you decide that that's worthy, there is Throne of Blood by Kurosawa, the Wells version, the Polanski version, the recent Denzel Washington.
Oh, no way am I ever doing this show with Macbeth. I am not going to do that. No way, Ange.
Okay.
Because it's not like I think Hamlet is superior to Macbeth. Of course I do. It's that I dislike Macbeth.
Fantastic.
If I were ever to do this, if I live long enough and I was going to, like, okay, let's do another one, I think I'd pick a comedy, right? This is a tragedy. Let's do a comedy.
Yeah,
something like that. It's not a promise.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say, if I get one last thought, is I just want to thank you very much for inviting me because, you know, I say it to you a lot in the comments. This podcast is like a full meal, right? You know, because I learn every single time. It makes me want, like, I want to see all of these different versions so that I can pick all of these things up. I just appreciate this tremendously.
Well, I appreciate your patronage. And that's why I wanted to invite you. I knew you were up to date on the material. I knew you'd read it. So I'm glad you could do it. In thanking you, I'll let you also tell the folks what you're working on right now.
I run a Supergirl blog called Comic Box Commentary. I review all of the current Superman titles, and I'll occasionally take some side missions like Black Orchid or the Mark Shore Manhunter when these things arise. And otherwise, you can find me. I'm still on Twitter/X to talk about comics mostly, but also old movies on TCM and things like this.
All right. I'll let you slip back to the library while I play a promo. And when I return, I'll address some of the feedback the show's gotten. A lot of it from you, Ange. Thanks.
Thank you.
Stick around. Siskoid watches a lot of movies. Like, a lot. So now he has his own movie podcast. Or several. Siskoid Cinema is your one-stop umbrella for a variety of shows like Fade In, exploring the first films of famous actors and directors.
This is a joke, right?
On Borrowed Time, discussing all your favorite time travel movies.
Whoa, this is heavy.
Why are things so heavy in the future? Is there a problem with the Earth's gravitational pull?
And No Escape from Kurt Russell, a dissection of the man, the mystique, and the movies.
There goes a perfectly good bumper sticker.
And more. Siskoid Cinema, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. We're back. Let's open the mailbag and read a few missives. Ward Hill Terry simply says, "This is such a damn good podcast." Thanks, Terry. Brian Linton goes, "Every time you talk about Jacoby's interesting take on Hamlet, I tell myself that I need to watch the BBC production of Hamlet. I'm pretty sure I have access to it on BritBox, not a sponsor, so I don't even have the excuse of not being able to find it. I just need to overcome inertia and make time to watch." Okay, I'm setting a goal to watch Jacoby's Hamlet before you wrap up Act 3. So have you, Brian? Let's see if I can make my conflict-avoidant, people-pleasing personality work in my favor. Well, I expect an update on this. Eric says, "Enjoying this series very much. Thought of another comic adaptation of Hamlet you might want to check out. Have you read Kyle Baker's The Cowboy Wally Show?" I have not. There's a section in the book where Cowboy Wally and his associates make a Hamlet movie despite several limitations, not the least of which is that they're all in jail at the time. Hardly a faithful adaptation, but it could be fun to bring it into the discussion. Well, I even have designs on Steve Coogan's Hamlet 2. So everything is, available to future guests of wrap-ups, and for whatever I decide to do with the show once season 5 has wrapped. Sean Ross says, "I'm wondering if you ever come across an interpretation that shows Hamlet and Horatio as lovers." Well, we're not there yet, but the Fodor version, that experimental version I keep coming back to, no one else has seen, does provide a moment for them. But here they're a man and a woman. So strictly speaking, the characters as two men, I don't think so. They must exist, right? Ange is all over the comments, but I think we address most of it in the body of the episode. Still, let me read one here. It says, there are some Shakespeare lines that have worked their way into my personal lexicon. Now I might do it while he's praying, but up sword is one of them. I'm really wondering, what's the context you would use this in? And my own vernacular includes a rat. You know, a rat, is it the king? And I've stabbed people through curtains in the past doing this bit for fun. Jack Bond says, I haven't seen Hamlet 2000, but I think I found a way to express my feelings with Shakespeare staged as if it's happening today. It's like Looney Tunes doing a literary adaptation. You can assign each cartoon character a role, but eventually you'll run into something that doesn't fit. Is there some reason they didn't do the obvious and replace the forgiveness of God with public opinion? Some of Claudius's lines could be taken as drafts of ideas for trying to get in front of the scandal. Of course, back in 2000, word did not get out to the public as fast as prayers go or don't go to heaven. So Hamlet's pause would be anticipating further spin rather than immediate translation to heaven. It also diminishes Hamlet from wanting judgment on Claudius's immortal soul to wanting to be right online. But Claudius has been reduced from law of the land as king to merely thinking he's above the law as CEO. Although, is there much of a difference if this were Hamlet 2024? I mean, you can only transform it so much, and Hamlet has to have a real reason to not do it. If you're going to say the spin is out there, the public is going to forgive him, and therefore I can't do it, you're starting to lose a lot of the lines there. Can he ever do it? Can he ever murder his stepfather? Because how do you actually make that PR not go up to heaven and remain below? You know, it's like he's not going to send it out. It gets a bit complicated if you're using the line. So maybe your Looney Tunes comparison is correct here. Well, that ends our look at Act 3. So thanks again to my guest, Dr. Ange. Next time we take our first bite out of Act 4 with its first three scenes in which Elsinore reacts to Polonius's murder. And if you have thoughts on this particular episode, of course, head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com. Let me know what they are. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/fwpodcasts. Thanks for listening, and I hope you, dear listener, will return for our fourth season, probably when Ryan Daly's Cheerscast takes its next hiatus. Though for now, you can find that show just starting its seventh season.
The rest is silence.